Oh, yeah. No, I strongly recommend if you're feeling a bit down and you're feeling a bit low, what you do is you just, if you've had a day like me where you've been playing with EIGRP variants, yeah, and you've been feeling a bit blue, you... Thank you. Thank you. No, you're too kind. Too kind.
Normal people would have gone down to the bar and just drank.
just perks you right up, really.
Oh.
You've missed this, haven't you, Ethan?
I have, yeah.
Welcome to Packet Pushers, the data networking podcast where real people discuss events, technology, and work life in the networking industry. During the week, we've gathered a bunch of articles from around the web, got some ideas, and then we're going to get together and flap our chins about them. Get comfortable while we get around the workbench and diagnose the problems of the network world with humor, wit, and just possibly some technical talent. Before we get started with the team meeting in around the virtual whiteboard, I just wanted to remind you that Packet Pushers is looking for sponsors and donations. A little bit more begging is needed, mainly around the sponsors. If you know somebody or you know where to go and get some, I'm struggling to keep the show going and it's getting bigger and bigger and it's taking more and more commitment of my time. And so what I'm looking for is a little bit of sponsorship to help me keep the show rocking out the door. As you know, each show takes between 5 to 8 hours to produce, and it's getting a bit of a struggle to do it as a full-time, when I'm balancing a full-time job and a family. So if you are a company who wants to reach out to 4,000-odd networking nerds who care enough to listen to a very technical show in their spare time, and are often senior or leaders within their respective organizations who make purchasing decisions, then Packet Pushers has a sponsorship option that you should talk to us about. It doesn't cost a lot, and it gets good results, according to people who've been here before. Now, if you're a listener to the show, there's three things you can do to help us out and get over this hump. One is to tell other people about us. Because as the numbers grow, it gets easier for me to convince advertisers that it's worth sponsoring the show. It's also easier to get big names and big companies on the show to join in the fun. And also leave a review on iTunes, blog about the show, talk us about us at conferences, hit the Facebook, the Twitter, whatever you can. The more people we have, the better the show gets. It makes it easier for me. There's a donation button on packetpushers.net, and if you could flip me some coffee money to say thanks, well, that would be awesome too. I'd particularly like to take this opportunity to say thanks to people who have donated. Some of you have been really, really generous, and I'm really, really grateful. More than I could ask for, and I'm truly grateful for your support. Third and finally, head up to Packet Pushers website and subscribe to the mailing list. Vendors tell me they'll pay money to be able to spam you. Send emails. Now, I'm not entirely happy, but I'll keep your details private from the mailing list. I won't sell it, and I'll send you content. So when we did the Arista webinar this week, I was able to use that mailing list to get in contact with you. That's valuable to us and invaluable to the companies who might sponsor the show. So I'll be careful to not be painful. There's a sign-up form in the sidebar at Packet Pushers. Well, without further ado, let's introduce the people on the show today. And thanks for listening through that. And so welcome back this week from a long sound hiatus is Ethan Banks. Oh, welcome back, Ethan.
Oh, nice to be on the show again. I got a couple of classes behind me that I took late winter, early spring here. And those being gone, I got a little more time freed up and glad to be on the mic again.
Yeah, it's good to have you back, buddy. You've been having fun doing that. You've been playing with firewalls, and you've been overhauling your network as well.
Yeah, so we got budget now, whereas when I came in a year ago, it was more, let's identify all the problems. Now we did the identification process, we got money in the budget, and so we're doing a lot of forklift upgrades, and a lot of that happens to be firewalls, so some old checkpoints on the way out, and some Cisco stuff on the way in. Yep. A lot of auditing and so on and so on. Yeah.
Okay. So checkpoints on the way out?
Mm-hmm.
Can I? Fantastic.
Very much so.
Can I get a look? Sorry, I couldn't help myself there. And also with us this week, as always, is Tom Hollingsworth. Tom, what's been happening with you this week?
Oh, I spent the week taking tests, so I am now officially a Telepresence Express field implementation engineer. Yay. So I don't know why they came to me with this, but they're like, hey, we need you to sit through about 10 hours of training and then take a whole bunch of tests over it. I'm like, well, I don't have anything else going on, so sure.
And you just looked at your paycheck and said, yeah, okay.
Yeah, pretty much. The life of a vendor.
Oh, it's just... golf clap for that one.
Golf clap.
And also with us this week is John McManus. How are you, John? What's been happening in Scotland?
Oh, it's been raining pretty much constantly all week. The barbecue was delayed this weekend. But back into networking, I've been doing some work this week with the ASR 1000s, trying to get them installed in a customer's WAN connection in line without having any downtime on the WAN, so some juggling of VLANs and OSPF. So yeah, it's always a challenge to try and keep 100% uptime.
Uptime. I've heard of that. All right. Well, I guess we should push on with the show this week and do the usual noise. I guess first things probably to talk about this week is there's a lot of rumors flying around about what Cisco's doing around restructuring their business. There's been various press articles around about Cisco ditching Linksys and WebEx. Who wants to have a shot at the title here before I get going?
I'll take a shot at it because I actually wrote a little bit on this on my blog this past week. I think getting rid of Linksys is probably going to end up being a really good thing for Cisco because they're going to stop concentrating on the low end of the market where there's a whole lot of competition and not a lot of profit. And it allows them to refocus on going after Juniper and HP, who are taking significant delight in snapping away at all the customer base that Cisco has in the enterprise. But Thursday, I think it was, I heard a really interesting rumor about the WebEx piece, because everybody who uses WebEx doesn't want it to go away. They think it's probably one of the greatest things ever. And the rumor that I heard was that if WebEx does eventually spin off or sell, that will be an indication that John Chambers will eventually have a vote of no confidence and will probably be on the outs as the chairman, and they'll bring somebody in new, because that would basically have unraveled his two largest acquisitions during his time in Cisco.
Linksys was big. He's much bigger than that. The two biggest acquisitions were Scientific Atlanta, which is cable modems. Good one there, John. That's worked out well. And the other one is the Telepresence stuff, which was an $8 billion, you know, the Tandberg stuff.
Right. Tandberg is the biggest one that he's done recently, and so they're still up in the air about that one. But the Scientific Atlanta one is probably the biggest concern that no one knows about, because they bought Scientific Atlanta,
yep,
and it disappeared into a black hole. I mean, I have a Scientific Atlanta cable box at home, and I'm thinking, oh, great, you know, we're going to have all this technology, and we're going to be able to do all these neat things with it. And the only thing we ever got out of it was, what, Yumi, the home telepresence unit that's now being buried as well?
Yeah, it's been discontinued, as far as I know.
Yeah.
Yep.
How many did the manufacturer of it? It was only about 10. I mean, that was just a laugh when it came out. It's like, who's got to, you can't get telepresence in corporate environments, you know, and they're trying to put them in the home when it's
Who's going to pay $30 a month for a
vet? Yeah.
And the sad thing is you have to know the other person on the other end has to have that unit. So it's the same problem that people had when the iPhone 4 came out with FaceTime. Mm. Okay, that's great. I've got FaceTime. I can call two people who just went and bought an iPhone.
Exactly. At least if it was working on Skype, I'd be able to, you know, if it had multi-codec something and it could call Skype and FaceTime and WebEx, then that would be worthwhile. But it couldn't even do that. Ethan, you were going to say?
It was a great idea The concept of throw a set-top box there with a camera and you get to use your TV on both sides and so on. But then the pricing was wrong. The monthly cost was unforgivable. I don't know. They really had a nice idea that they could have done something with, and they just marketed it bad, structured it bad. It just couldn't have taken too much of a focus group to sit down and sort that out and made that something successful. It really could have gone somewhere, and they blew it.
Here's a prediction for you. Microsoft buy Skype, Microsoft have Xbox, Xbox now does teleconferencing using Skype.
And I don't think anybody's questioning that it was the right thing to do, but their execution was so poor. Mm. I mean, if you look at all the things that Cisco's got wrong, flip, right choice, wrong execution. They, instead of buying Pure Digital and trying to bring out a phone, they just tried to bring out a camera because they didn't want to make a phone. They've made the CS, but have been completely outclassed by the Android and the iPad and everybody else who's making a tablet. Who's going to buy a Cisco CS tablet? I mean, is that ever going to come out?
It's out, I guess. You can find them somewhere.
Yeah, but they haven't been launched as far as I know. I haven't seen a product launch. They've still sort of... They won't do anything until Android 3.1, I don't think.
They're certainly not pushing it hard if it's out there.
Yeah.
No, you have to order it through a partner right now. It's restricted.
It'll be
I mean, that's a big marketing problem for them, because the key thing about where the Apple's driving it from, where these other companies are driving it from, is just the consumer market and taking it into the workplace, not the workplace and taking it home. You know, and to me, that's the massive failing of anything that's tied directly into corporates for these things, because you just lose all that flexibility you get with your home device straight out of the box.
There's a bit of a perfect storm there as well. I mean, if you could give people a CS and say, here's your tablet, away you go. But what we've also got coming is this bring your own computing stuff going on in the background. A lot of companies are actually saying, well, we're not going to provide them with a tablet. They can go and buy their own iPad and we'll give them some software to run on that. Mm-hmm. You know, the overall demand for the product is missing. So, you know, if you look at, and Linksys, completely, they flap that because they're at least twice as expensive as any other product in the, when I go down to the local electronics store, which I've been three times in the last 3 years, I must say. But I've looked at the Linksys product and, you know what, I'm running on my desk and it's not a Linksys because it was twice the price. I did actually buy one and I couldn't get it to work and took it back to the store and got a refund. And I now run, you know, some two-bit companies as a wireless router, because it was just, you know, better than the Cisco product. It didn't, you know, I'm not sure what Linksys is doing as special value. They thought if they, you know, sprinkled some Cisco fairy dust, people would jump all over it.
Well, have you ever seen the Cisco Valet, their line of idiot-proof wireless routers?
No.
That was probably the biggest, to me, the biggest slap in the face, because, well, fair disclaimer, I've got one upstairs because it was given to me. But it's a rebranded Linksys router with software layer shimmed on top of it. And what it does is it basically makes an easy device even easier to set up, to the point where it's almost hard for someone like me to work on it, because I have to figure out how to get in the back door to change settings on it. And it was so overpriced that you go into the store now and they're cheaper than the regular Linksys routers, just because people who know better won't buy one. And so they're taking huge write downs on that. And, you know, where's the profit? Because you're already losing money in this environment anyway. Because, I mean, these PCBs coming out of, you know, the Far East, they probably cost, what, like $4, something like that?
Yeah, they do. They cost nothing. I mean, the other thing that annoys me about Cisco is their over thing about video. They're so excited about video. Video is the future. They, you know, they say, you know, I spoke to a number of execs when I was in Interop, and all they could say is that, you know, that video is going to be 60% of the internet by 2000 and something or another. And I went, no, it's going to be more packets than ever that will have video content in them. That doesn't make it video content that you have to create.
Yeah, they almost sound like they're talking about interactive video, but I mean, are they really talking about Netflix and related streaming services?
They're talking about interactive video because they see things like Netflix, which is like, what, 30% of the traffic that has been diagnosed on the internet. But the problem is that people aren't all that thrilled with interactive video. They like the capability of getting a video on demand. And yes, that's going to generate tons of packets too. But you're right, you need to take an agnostic view of this. It's not, we want to be the people behind generating the content. It's more of the line, like a car dealer. We want to be the people that convey the pieces from one side to the other. We want to sell
packets.
You the equipment to get there.
It doesn't matter what's packets, in it. Packet. Cisco's job is to make the packets go from point A to point B, whether they contain video or images or voice or, you know, text or whatever. Who cares? You know, they can have, Cisco's job is to transport them from point A to point B, not generate the content. It's like a telephone carrier. You know, when they give you your mobile phone and then they start trying to add value, add services by selling you ringtones and give you streaming video and access to a music library, you just sit there and go, you sad losers. You've completely missed the point. The point is, it's a phone, and I'll get my services from someone who does it properly. I'm not going to buy them from you.
Yeah, but there's some board of directors that would disagree with that logic. They'll say, what do we have to do to increase stockholder value? And that means more revenue. We got to generate more revenue. If we can sell ringtones, if we can sell Linksys routers, if we can sell whatever it is that we can sell that are going to put more numbers up, they perceive that as good. And they're learning that when they kill products or confuse what the customers perceive the company to be, that it doesn't end up being a win and they aren't growing market. And it seems like they buy, and then now Cisco's going through this process of selling all this stuff and quote unquote refocusing. It's kind of interesting how it all comes around, but I think it a lot of times comes back to that board of directors who are looking at numbers, and that's they don't really see a whole lot beyond that.
Yes.
Yeah.
In the meantime, HP and Juniper have been eating Cisco's lunch, for sure.
Well, be snacking on it. Not that they're eating their lunch completely, but they're certainly making some nibbles.
Well, at Interop, just a disclosure here, I went to Interop as a guest of HP Networks. They flew me over there and gave me some accommodation so that I could meet HP executives. I didn't receive anything else. I didn't receive any remuneration, nor is any of my content censored or encouraged by them. So I would like to say thanks for HP for taking me to Interop. I met some really nice people and had a good time. I also met up with a range of other companies at Interop, and it's clear that HP and Juniper are sort of, if you chat to the right people in the right places, they've done very, very nice business over the last year, and it's all been taken from Cisco, not from anywhere else. They're pretty chuffed about it, in fact. And you can see the proof of that in the fact that HP's just been launching a whole raft of new products recently, and Juniper's come out with their Q Fabric, which isn't following the industry. It's actually going in an orthogonal direction in terms of their Q Fabric product. And I think Cisco's been losing a lot of revenue in their core enterprise market, at least into certain parts of the market anyway.
Then what about the WebEx part then? We've talked a lot about the Linksys and dumping that, and that seems pretty obvious to me. WebEx. It's a pretty decent product, but it doesn't seem core to what Cisco do as far as making hardware and software to run on it to move data around about the network.
I think WebEx is a different problem. I have heard from some insiders that the WebEx acquisition was not the greatest acquisition in the world. When they bought Scientific Atlanta, it took them about 8 months to close the deal. And they closed WebEx in a matter of weeks. And so they were trumpeting the fact that by using WebEx to close the deal, we were able to have meetings and things like that. Well, from what I understand internally, WebEx never figured out that they had been bought by Cisco. And for a long time, even after the acquisition closed, they were still closing deals as the WebEx team. And so eventually a senior VP came in and just started canning people left and right and then said, all right, does anybody else here not work for Cisco? And then they finally got the picture that they were a subsidiary. And that's when they started rebranding it as Cisco WebEx as opposed to WebEx, a division of Cisco.
Well, and so WebEx doesn't seem like a natural fit for Cisco to me either. I mean, WebEx has got nothing to do with networking.
You're right. They positioned WebEx as a replacement for some of the pieces of their collaboration cloud. So Meeting Place, which they were having to license technology from Adobe, WebEx basically became their web version of Meeting Place. Yeah. And so what their idea was is that they were going to try to find a way to bring WebEx into a client's environment. It doesn't work like that.
Yeah. If they were going to integrate cloudy. It with that stupid IP telephony stuff, why haven't they integrated with the IP telephony stuff?
I don't think they can.
Here's my question, though. If Cisco does dump WebEx, that's rumors. Let's say they do that, and let's say that they get rid of Linksys. In addition to these other we as networking guys would consider their non-core products, does this get them to the point where they are going to be able to focus more on the core products and some of this business that Juniper and HP have taken away from them? Are they going to get it back? There was some rumors going around a little bit ago when Cisco had a Nexus-related announcement. There was a picture up there that had a Nexus 7009 chassis sitting in the background that wasn't supposed to be there in the picture. Some people caught on to it real quick. Ooh, look at that. When I want that one. When can I get that? Well, it's not really ready yet and so on. Why isn't it ready yet? Is it because they have these non-core businesses that are taking away cycles that would keep them from bringing a Nexus 7009 or 7006 to market? Or are these non-core businesses kind of self-contained units, and when they dump them, they just dump them? And, that's my question, because I've heard the story told both ways.
Well, let me ask you this question, Ethan, because I can kind of frame this in a different manner. You stopped doing packet pushers for a few months because you were trying to focus on a class.
Mm.
Did you start doing better in class because you stopped doing packet pushers, or because after you cut that part out of your time, you then refocused yourself in the class? Because those are two separate steps. Just selling off all these extra business units is not really going to help Cisco unless the organizational structure changes and they go back again and say, all right, we need to concentrate on our key areas of routing and switching, telephony, data center, and we need to be the best at those things instead of always looking for the next best thing, the next market transition, the next widget that people want to buy.
Mm. Yeah, and what's the key thing for organizational transformation? To get a new CEO?
Well, I think that if WebEx spins, that you will see a new CEO within 6 months.
Who do you think would buy WebEx from them?
I don't know if they necessarily would need to buy WebEx. They may just spin it into its own little unit.
Yep. As long as it's not part of Cisco, push it at arm's edge and then get ready to float it out at some point in the next year.
Look at the number of people.
Push them into a new campus and say, getting ready to sell, and they've got a year to get rid of it then.
Yeah.
That's Cisco without Chambers at the helm is that's almost a bizarre thought.
Kind of like Apple without Steve Jobs. To a certain degree. He's been there for so long, but I think that's part of the problem is he's been there for so long.
Yeah, but he spends all his time flying around the world attending G8 conferences and G20 and telling Obama how to be something or another and heading off to China to meet Hu Weichang, you know, whatever it is, and doing what's he really doing for the company if he's off doing that stuff? The real challenge is deeper down in the organization when he federated the business model. So he took the business units, tore them up into pieces and said, you're all independent business units. And you just report to me at the executive level and let them all compete with each other.
The theory is Chambers is the visionary leader. I mean, that's what Jobs is doing for Apple. He says, this is what I see. This is where I want to go. And these are the products and how I want them to act and feel and make it like this. And then we'll sell it. And that's proven to be extremely successful for Apple. And in theory, Chambers is doing the same thing. He's the vision. He sees where he wants the business to go. Only that vision seems to keep changing.
Yeah, lack of focus, in my opinion. It's not vision that's the problem, it's the lack of focus. So instead of the executive team focusing on the end-to-end portfolio and saying this is what we do and this is where the portfolio fits together, they've got all these business units pulling in about 20 different directions. I mean, you have, could you imagine the day when the C4500 core switch, you know, that access switch is now faster performing than the 6500?
Mm.
That tells me that those divisions aren't pulling together to produce a single company. They're all individual business units competing for different throws. As GigaOm points out too, I mean, for example, this week GigaOm posted an article about is Cisco on the out with EMC and VMware? The reason for that is that Cisco's been partnering very heavily with NetApp lately and have won a lot of deals. If you've been watching the design papers and some of the tweets and the noise coming out from Cisco's data center team, they've done a lot of heavy partnering with NetApp in the last, I don't know, 2 months, 3 months.
And Citrix.
And Citrix and Microsoft. And yet, for 2 years before that, it was all VMware. So has... You know, you could speculate around that. And the GigaOm article says, is that because Cisco's looking to buy NetApp? Which is a good point. NetApp's a better acquisition for Cisco than EMC is. It's a much easier buy. It's a networking-centric company in terms of storage networking. EMC doesn't fit because it owns VMware as well as RSA and then the storage unit. Or is it about diversifying? Is that because, you know, John Chambers can't make an acquisition now because he's no longer secure in his job and the executive team knows they're under pressure? So they want to diversify their risk and say, we can't just focus on VMware. We need to have, NetApp to diversify our storage partnerships. Let's go and get into bed with Microsoft and Citrix and certify UCS for Hyper-V and get some Citrix stuff for Hyper-V. And, you know, there's all this plethora of, you know, new business things going on. You know, what's Cisco's drive around that? We've been told for the last 3 years it's VMware, and EMC. Now it's what?
I wish I had answers. If I did, I could probably make a fortune.
Well, speaking of which, Juniper this week announced Junisphere, which is their cloud-based offering of Junos, which is an availability by the cloud. Now, this had been bigged up to me by some people at Juniper as being something I was going to get excited about. And when the announcement came out, I realized that it's all about, A, it's in the cloud, which is about useful, as Tetson a ball. because having it in the cloud's no help to me. The offering as it is strictly limited to Juniper Academic Alliance partners, which is universities and certain reseller-based learning institutions. So if it's so great, why am I not able to use it? Has anybody else looked into it?
Why don't you expand on about why it's no use to you, Greg?
Well, the answer is the configurations and the testing and the labbing that I need to do needs to be in configurations that I want. And I need to be able to prepare that when I'm on a plane or I'm on a train. I can't be, you know, SSH'd or telneted into some remote site. Just about all the organizations I work for don't allow SSH or telnet out through the firewall, so I can't access it when I'm at work. I can only access it when I'm outside the corporate firewall. And finally, that, you know, when you've spent 4 weeks designing a network change and you've labbed it all up and then you activate it at 10:30 at night and shut off the internet connection and it doesn't work, you still don't have access to the cloud, do you? So it's just not useful. It has to be, and I've said the same thing about Cisco's so-called cloud offering around IOU, has to be on your desktop, has to be useful, has to be in a VM that you've got on your machine that you can run at any time of the day, and it's got to be free. I've already paid a license for Junos. I don't want to. The rumored pricing I've heard for the Junosphere is $5 per router per day.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you wholeheartedly. And I hope this is like a phase one release. I hope Cisco's is a phase one release where it's geared up for academic, for studying for exams. But there's a real need out there for their engineers to have access to prepare labs for changes, so they can ratify them beforehand, so they can make sure that they have least impact to network as possible, and with the lowest cost to do that, because customers are not able to invest in lots and lots of equipment, so they can build a lab that represents a network. Fair enough, we can't do it in hardware and get all the nice hardware features, but just being able to pull together a EIGRP cloud or an MPLS cloud or OSPF and make the changes there that may or may not impact the network. But at least we can prove that. We can go with confidence to the business saying, yeah, in the lab we've tested this. This is going to be what we expect to happen. We've proven this. So if it goes wrong in the live environment, then you get something to baseline it on. And I think that's the key going forward. So I'm hoping for a step two where they take the stuff out of the cloud and give the ability to push some of that back to the people once have passed a certification would actually use it for their day-to-day job.
I think you'll be wishing. The suggestion mm-hmm. I've been told is that that's not the way they're going. They're going to want to squeeze money out of it. It's coming. The initiative's coming from the training department, just like Cisco is. And the training department has to make money out of it. It's not a company-wide initiative. It hasn't come from the top. And we're going to be screwed over again.
Yeah, but they're missing it. They're not getting it. If they want to improve adoption of Juniper and JunOS in the enterprise particularly, where there's a whole lot of money to be made, they got to get engineers on board with it. I'm not going to go out to any great lengths to pay for access to a resource like this. I got a lot of other things that I can do that are free. If they want to really get me on board with this thing and behind JunOS and all excited about this and so on, they should be able to release a limited license, not limited functionality, but limited license, sort of a JunOS emulator, so that I can get familiar with the command line, comfortable with what the product can do, start to understand how it would migrate my Cisco infrastructure over to a Juniper one, you know, take that learning curve element, that fear of the unknown kind of away, so that I can just get in there and go for it. The Juniper guy comes in, and I tell my boss, "Hey, we got this Cisco gear that's ready to go." And the Juniper guy is here, and yeah, it's different, but I'm comfortable. I know how to configure it. I was playing with the emulator, and I've already got half the code written that we'd need to write to do business the way we need to do business around here.
Or even take away your own uncertainty. You can go and work on the interface until you're confident. I mean, you're not going to switch from Cisco to Juniper unless certainly the vast majority of people aren't going to switch until they feel confident that they can run the interface and drive it. If, you know, Juniper they did a great job with those training programs 6 months to a year ago with, you know, Junos for Cisco people or something like that. Was that the name of them?
Yeah, something like that.
Something like that. You know, and that sort of, for the first time, that was my introduction to Junos, and it was a great start. I don't feel that the hurdle for me to move into Junos is as bad as it might otherwise be. If this isn't free and freely available on my desktop, then I'm not, you know, able to go into big teams in big companies and say, guys, we're going to move to Junos. Here's an emulator. Go and work on it at night. No excuses. We're going to do it, right? If I can't do that, then I'm not going to recommend Junipers. It's a much harder, much bigger decision. It's much more strategic. You know, I have to go and send them all to courses and then wait for them all to skill up and build a lab and, you know.
Would you consider this as a value add to maybe a course like JunOS for iOS people? Say, for instance, you go to like a two-day class where they run down the list and they're like, oh, hey, by the way, here's a DVD that contains images of three JunOS virtual routers that you're only allowed to use these three, but configure them however you want to get them to talk to each other so you can see how OSPF and ISIS interact. No. That wouldn't do it for you?
Have to be able to lab it. Have to be able to dynamips it. Have to be able to make the configurations that I want to see. Otherwise, I'm not going to feel that I can, you know, short of buying $250,000 worth of Junos and having it in a lab that I can play with, I'm just never going to have the necessary time and energy to work out how to run it.
Well, that's what it boils down to, is the fact that the training department is now trying to push for virtualized routers because everybody is starting to have virtual equipment, basically, where, you know, like Arista, their platform is can be completely virtualized. So Cisco and Juniper, and probably HP to a smaller degree, are now looking at this going, we could have sold them $50,000 worth of lab gear, and now you're wanting to give them this product, or in some cases, sell it to them for a substantially reduced cost.
This makes all sorts of sense for universities and learning companies because they don't have to invest any money in owning an asset anymore.
Exactly.
A rapidly depreciating asset that needs reinvesting again. It makes training heaps cheaper overall.
So how would this affect your training companies? And one that I can use, for example, is someone like IP Expert, who has a warehouse full of racks of equipment for all their students. So now if I can virtualize, and I don't necessarily think that GNS and Dynamips and all those programs have really cut into that because of the differences between how we have to emulate those products on a local machine versus the way a real router behaves. But if you could get a real behaving router, which is almost what IOU does now, I mean, if you make it easy to set up and things like that, you're going to have those people screaming bloody murder.
No, the IP Expert will be more than keen. They don't want to run that business.
Well, if they get a warning starting, let's just say, tomorrow, that this is the direction we're going to go, they can retire all that equipment and set up virtualized racks, and they'll be fine.
Yeah, exactly. And that's exactly what Junos would do. I mean, I'm not going to talk about the Cisco side of it, but, you know, the Juniper side, if I'm a Juniper training partner, I no longer have to drop how many bucks on, you know, Junos kit.
Do you think that by making it freely available to other training partners that would spur the adoption of the cottage industry that comes around these type of things where you have training vendors that are willing to offer you Juniper classes and try to speed that adoption?
Yeah.
That's how you spin it to Juniper, in my mind, is to say, guess what? If you can make this available to people who are willing to train other people how to use it, then you're going to get the word out. And then, you know, because, you know, in some cases, for a lot of people, Juniper is one of those companies that's really great, but I've never heard of them.
Yeah, I mean, to me, Juniper are really missing a trick here, not about trading, but just about sales. And I think it was you, Ethan, were talking about just, you know, like getting your toes wet, if you like, in the Junos environment, so that when it comes down to replacing the equipment in the future, you now feel a bit more confident on how to drive it. So if they release that to engineers like yourself, like me, because I would be interested in seeing, well, this is how I do it in Cisco. Let me just lab this and see how I do it in Junos and start to feel comfortable about how the network will look under a Junos environment. So when it comes to them selling the hardware at the door, then, you know, you're breaking down that confidence barrier and say, yeah, actually, we could drive this and make it work. And we know we can do the features that we've already got. You know, so I think they're missing a massive opportunity to trip Cisco up and start knocking down some doors, because they'll now have engineers that, because they're enthusiastic about the environment, they've started looking in and start to feel comfortable about it.
Some enterprises have really complex configurations on their routers and switches too, particularly if they have an elaborate QoS scheme. Those are the kind of things someone's going to want to know. I can make this go on a non-Cisco platform, and this is how we're going to do it. It's not going to take us a lot of time to get over that learning curve.
Complicated quasi schemes are generally due to the line cards on the 6500s.
Okay, that's fair.
I don't think you're going to solve hardware-specific challenges in emulators, and nor could we expect the vendors to. So if you have, you know, that sort of thing, that's just part of the, there are limits on what they can achieve. And I think we can respect that. I don't think we can ask for more. But maybe over time they could even solve that, I guess. But, you know, still, enough. It needs to be, you know, this whole emulator issue is about getting your products, making it a lower friction, making it easier for us to adopt these products, not making it harder. And these emulators are really quite valuable. And I think a lot of Cisco's success has been around the fact that Dynamips has been freely available for a number of years, helped their training and stuff. And, you know, they need, all the companies need to sort it out. Second. One of the things I saw when I was at Interop last week was OpenFlow and how it works to create network virtualization. I know I've written a couple of articles about it, and a lot of our good friend Ivan Pepelniak has been a bit of a naysayer about the whole thing. But I was reading an article this week from Citrix. There'll be a link in the show notes where they talk about how OpenFlow is going to be changing the way they work. And it reminded me to point out that OpenFlow, in the demo of the interoperability lab that they actually had running, is they had a big lab of four racks of kit, and they actually had Juniper switches, Cisco, not Cisco switches, Juniper, Blade Networks, NEC, a whole bunch of them, and a Citrix virtual server with its vSwitch implementation. And the OpenFlow controller was actually able to create a switching infrastructure out of all of that at once. So you could go in and create a virtual a switch port on the Juniper, a switch port on the Citrix vSwitch, Open vSwitch, Open Switch, which it's got. You could create a switch on the NEC switch, and you could then say that's one virtual switch. And the OpenFlow controller was then adapting all of that to bring it all together into one thing. To me, that is the value behind OpenFlow. Now, OpenFlow's got a long way to go. Don't get me wrong, they've barely come out of prototype phase, in much less alpha. But the potential of the product is significant in terms of being able to change the way we work. Have any of you guys been reading up on OpenFlow and got some awareness? Ethan, are you au fait with it?
Not enough to comment a lot. I can say I'm intrigued by the concept. What new hardware is going to come to bear that's running OpenFlow, and what's that going to mean? Like you were pointing out, there's a lot of potential there, a lot of interesting things.
Well, I guess there's a couple of things. A, it's going to be, it de-emphasizes the focus of the network device. So to me, the way we currently have our networks today is we have a switch and a switch and a router and a router, and we configure all of those as individual elements. And we have these protocols which bring them together into a coherent one. So when I have a switch, you know, if I have a data center network and I've got 30 or 40 switches in my data center, it's spanning tree which brings all of those switches into one thing, or it's OSPF which brings my IP routing into one system. But I still use my SSH to go and telnet into, you know, SSH into every device and configure them individually. I don't treat it like it's an entire system, but it is an entire system. It's one functional unit. OpenFlow is, as a concept, says I'm going to strap a software layer over the top of all my switches, and then I'm going to be able to operationally gather this port over here and this port over here and give that as one virtual switch. Or I'm going to change things. I'm going to say, oh, hang on, you see that load that's flowing between those links? That's beyond some threshold. So I'm going to create an automated rule which starts shedding load onto a second pathway in the data center. Now, some of this is futures, some of this is here today. So, for example, I was speaking to a guy from HP Networks, Charles Clark, who was a director of research, and they've just contributed the QoS code to the OpenFlow project as part of their work, which is, you know, putting QoS into OpenFlow is going to be able to allow all sorts of interesting things to happen. So it's the controller is a software platform that sits on the top and talks down to the switches. What the controller can program into it is going to be whatever it becomes. It's whatever the OpenFlow people can imagine to put into the software, I guess. And that will be the interesting part, because we'll be actually able to programmatically say things. I went to a session where one of the people from Facebook was talking about what they hope to have. And what they want, they have currently have a lab environment, and they have some preliminary plans to put it into certain parts of their network as live. And what they'll be doing is going and buying white box switches made by Broadcom, with just some operating system that's the bare minimum to accept commands. And they'll have some sort of controller in the cloud that's programming that switch. So if, as and when they need to just put more and more switches in, they just add them in, the controller knows about them and turns them into part of the control, the network. and they have all this software which just sits there and analyzes it and says, oh, that's some traffic, or this server's plugged into it, or quite hard to explain just how radical it will affect. What it does do, the net effect it does have, is that it means that iOS as an operating system becomes less important. Your focus in your network shifts away from the iOS on the router to the controller software, because the controller software becomes important. So the big opportunity for companies like Juniper and Cisco that I perceive at this time is that it's the development of this open flow software, this management platform that's scriptable, programmable, configurable, all sorts of ables that delivers new features to our networks that we haven't even thought of yet.
As you're pointing out, it's still all very, very new. Did you get any sense of how long before this becomes reality, something that we gotta contend with?
It's already in use at universities in the U.S. So Indiana University is already running, I think they're talking something like 30 or 40 devices in live. The Indiana University has an interesting network. They have 4,000 wireless access points and 3,000 switches in their campus. And they have big problems keeping that together. And what they want to be able to do is to say, you know, during the work day, they want the network to look like this. During the student day, the network looks like this. But at night, the students can use the resources in a different way. And they want to be able to reprogram it at night to allow greater access to the internet and, you know, different sorts of, QoS stuff. So that during the day, email and educational stuff works. How do you program 3,000 switches to have a different profile? You write a Perl script or an expect script that goes out and logs into each one. What they're also doing is they're also saying, we want to know of every MAC address. So what we want to do is turn those switches into a firewall so that only approved devices can connect to the network. So what they're doing is they're actually using, they're working now on OpenFlow configurations that say this MAC address has to match this operating system and this data for a sort of a NAC type of an arrangement, and say, I'm going to program the TCAM, that's the MAC forwarding table, to recognize this data and then load that rule into the system. I talked to another, saw a demo from NEC, and they showed me a group of switches. And when you unplug the cable, it actually sends OpenFlow messages that this port's down, and the controller actually says, well, that link goes from here to here because we built that view dynamically. And you see the link pull out. And they had other parts of it where they were actually saying that port goes to that IDS, and they were programming the IDS and the port with the necessary configuration to do the diversion to send the stuff into security. It's still so early, but it does hold a lot of promise for managing very large networks with a proper, sophisticated scripting, programmatic management platform that works in a way that we don't know today, and that's what I'm interested in. And I think because it'll come out of universities, so the universities will do this because it gives them features that they've been needing for 20 years. And then once something works in a university, the enterprises will start to say, I think that could fit our business over here, because it, you know, and start trialing it. And the other people who are really big on it, which was they were talking about again at Interop in a session, was that the mobile carriers are very big on this. Very, very big, because IP has no information. So the 3GPP protocol, which is used by mobile phones to deliver IP, so has all the billing data and the information about the user's handset in it. But when they do IP, they cannot check that who's sending the IP packet in is actually billed. The only time they get to validate the mobile phone is when it attaches to the network. And the use of OpenFlow has possibilities for them to be able to control and manage every part of the mobile experience in the future. So if you can imagine that both of those actually stick, you've got the universities coming from the bottom up for large size networks, large enterprise networks, and you've got the mobile carriers bringing it down into the service provider space, you've got a fair chance that OpenFlow is going to get some traction and then actually move into the mass market in the middle over time. Oh, sorry, did I talk too much again?
No, it's just trying to wrap my head around OpenFlow. I've been trying to do that since I listened to the last episode about it. It's starting to make sense.
It's still very proto, so I will freely admit that I'm probably boosting something that may never happen. And but I am excited about it. This ability to finally get control over all my network elements and be done with spanning tree, and be done with, you know, Trill and all those things. I don't think they even needed, or the possibility of not even using those to generate the forwarding tables on my devices, to completely have my network controlled according to the way I want it to be to meet the needs of my business is what excites me. And that's what it is. I don't need to put up with any of these rubbish protocols that don't necessarily work the way that I want them.
Yeah, it seems like there's a play here for virtualization and vSwitches as well, because it doesn't conceptually the switch hardware could be just NICs in the hypervisor environment and send them open flow instructions to do what you want to do instead of having to do a vSwitch with all kinds of layering and all the rest of it. Just abstract it and make it open flow.
Yep.
There's a lot of new extensions.
So just to add insult to injury, I met Alwin Sequeira from VMware in the OpenFlow session and talked to him about what he expects to be able to do. And he said that if it progresses, then VMware will support it. You'll be able to program the vSwitch from the networking space, not from the server space. And that will be valuable in the longer term. Even in the short term, what you'd be able to do is to create a virtual switch and then give it to the server guys and say, but they only get the ports that they're VMware servers. They don't log into the device. They just log into the controller and say, here's the thing. So I got a demo from the Juniper person, and they were actually showing me the flows going across Junos. Junos has only got it in a prototype phase, or it's barely escaped from the lab. And she was showing me how you can actually use OpenFlow to set the rules, and then you can see the flow on the router. And they were actually using it to set MPLS, which I thought was amazing. So it's not just a piece of paper with some ideas flapping around. These are real products with admittedly pre-release or lab-based code on the devices, but it is, you know, needs to be validated and it needs to sort out all those problems, but it is really there. There's evidence that it's ready to go. All right. I've bored you enough with OpenFlow. Let's move on. This week, I think it's David Gentry talked this week about just weld it to the rack. He has a great blog at codingrelic.geekhold.com, and he talks about network equipment vendors say never let the customer unscrew the chassis from the rack. Replace every component with upgraded equipment and never upgrade the chassis itself, because as soon as the customer unbolts the chassis, they can go to tender or consider a different vendor at that point. In the meantime, they just keep buying new modules and you keep slotting them home. Does that sound like the 6500 to you, Tom?
That's exactly what it sounds like to me. The only time you ever have to take a 6500 out of a rack is to put a 6500E in there, basically to switch out the backplane. And that's it makes total sense. And when you get to something the size of a Nexus 7000, it literally takes the whole rack. I mean, that's what they want. And as long as they can keep, you know, churning out line cards and supervisor engines and new power supplies to support whatever you want to put in there, you know, the hope is that you eventually forget that there's a switch in there. That, you know, it just you just keep buying pieces for it. Now, in reality, what's going to end up happening is that, at least I think that, you know, when things like OpenFlow come along and hardware becomes, you know, significantly less important, you're going to have to find a way to start differentiating yourself all over again. Mm.
I mean, that's the idea behind the service modules, of course, is that...
yeah. It's exactly... Hey, we've already got a 6509 in here. We could put a firewall in there. That should be easy, right?
I'm done with service modules, by the way.
Sorry.
I've been a big fan of service modules for the 6500 in the past, and I've been burned on them too many times now. I'm never going back. External individuals for everything.
Well, I think it's pretty telling that, as far as I know, there are no service modules for the Nexus 7K.
Yeah, well, that's a different sort of a challenge. They're struggling just to get the software out the door, much less add features and value to it, in my view. I mean, my view is that the Nexus is just, they're struggling just to get the roadmap, much less add value by putting service modules in.
And that's probably one of the reasons why they've kept the 6500 along for so long, is that it's reliable. It's the old man of the networking industry, which I thought was really funny when HP announced at Interop all of their new A10500 series switches, and they were touting their throughput and scalability numbers versus a 6509. And a few people on my Twitter feed were asking the question, well, why are you comparing them to a 10-year-old switch? And that, well, the thing was, is that question was actually asked on the call. And Cisco said, we're comparing them to the Switch that we see in all the environments. So it's like, ooh, good point. Yeah. They're like, well, why aren't you comparing these versus a Nexus 7K? And the guy said, do you really honestly think we're going to see a Nexus 7K in a campus environment outside of the data center? People don't buy Nexus 7Ks to run the core of their network. Yeah, they buy it to run their data center.
Nope. Because the QoS on the Nexus 7000 isn't quite there yet for campus stuff. And everybody's got 6500 chassis in their campus. Who's got them? Yeah, it is odd that the 10500, for what it's worth, is also a merchant silicon switch. So it's not actually HP's silicon inside. No, it's not 3COM.
Yeah, I had a running workshop this morning, so I just got back.
Is there anything you don't do? Like, are you good at everything, like running and being fit and, you know, like having children and everything all at the same time?
Oh, no. No kids.
No, I don't no do kids.
No all kids. Right. No regrets. Sorry. I don't want little things that might be like me or look like me running around, being annoying. No.
If you like ones that run around and look like me and act like me, I can ship you mine.
No. No kids. No kids. Please, God, no.
All right. So just give me a sec here to introduce Mrs. Y. She's returning. She's a little late today, but welcome to the show, Mrs. Y.
Hello.
We've got Ethan and Tom and John with us, and we'll just pick up. We haven't actually covered any of your fantastic security topics yet, so I guess the back half of the show will be all security whining.
Now, I thought it was more along the lines of snarkiness. I'm fully certified, according to Cisco, in snark.
No, lately I've been getting whiny, biased, or bitchy, actually, from all the Cisco people.
Smarmy and snarkiness are my specialty.
So we were talking about the HP 10500. The 10500, which was announced by HP at Interop, is a pretty cool switch, but it's got some pretty thumping numbers. It goes really, really fast and everything, and which I think is cool. But and I like the look of the chassis. So I had some in a blog post on Ethereal Mind. I took some photos of the internals, and it's a really, really sparse piece of kit. So the actual line cards and everything have got very, very, very few chips on them. But it turns out that it's actually running on a Broadcom chipset. So in the same way that Cisco recently announced the Nexus 3000, which is running a Broadcom Ethernet and silicon engine to do high-speed, low-latency forwarding, HP's come out with a chassis-based version of that. Looks a little bit like the 7000 in that it has a number of silicon slots in the rear. It has four of them. And the line cards do 10, 40, and will go up to 100 in the near future. All the speeds and feeds are all listed in the appropriate places. So I, you know, go off and waste your time looking at all that sort of stuff. But the fact that they're producing a Broadcom version of a campus switch says something about the state of merchant silicon to me, because they have the ProCurve silicon, which they've been developing for years and is developed by HP in the US. They have the HP networking, or the 3COM Comware silicon, which is part of the 3COM acquisition, and that's where their A12000s come from. And now all of a sudden they bring the 10500 out of the woodwork to fill out the line. I'm starting to question the forward-looking strategy of custom silicon even more. And even though Uncle John told us at Cisco Live in London a while back that, you know, one of our great corporate values here at Cisco is our ability to make custom silicon, and then 2 months later punch out a merchant silicon switch, we just have to question whether that's going to be something going on into the future.
I mean, why has it taken these guys so long? Even Apple got, you know, dropped the power PC. So.
Yeah, well, that's the thing about merchant silicon. It's like Intel chipsets. Every server vendor takes Intel chipsets and slaps them on a motherboard with some glue. Now, if we can do the same with networking, well, you know, we can get on with delivering some serious features into these things. Why are we wasting time building custom silicon?
Because a lot of these guys are dinosaurs, I think, honestly.
Yeah, that's true.
It is. They've got huge R&D departments developed around building specific purpose-built chips that they throw into equipment, and then they say, oh, we got to pay for the R&D guys. Let's charge a lot for this. When you just buy, you know, merchant silicon off the shelf and shove it into a switch, you can lower your prices. So then you get customers coming back to them going, all right, you put merchant silicon in this chip, and we know the chipset that's running it. Remind me again why you're charging 20% more than your competition.
Well, it's not only that. If they're not charging for the proprietary hardware, then we really start to look at their software and think, like, for example, I don't know, Avaya, my favorite whipping boy. Wait a second. What are we actually buying here?
Yeah. But they mean well.
Nice try.
They're nice people. They're Canadians, mostly, in the networking team. They're good folks.
Hey, they started it.
Well, when was the last time you had to deal with Avaya?
I've made a point of it.
In any official capacity or on the back of a hand truck taking it out of a customer's environment?
Could you bring that hand truck over to where I work?
Actually, believe it or not, there is kind of an underground market for people who are pulling older systems out and putting them on eBay. And I did that with a couple of pieces that I pulled out of an environment. And I got a call from a bidder within like 2 hours. He was like, I'll take it. I'll pay whatever you want. Just ship it to me. And I guess that there's just like there's a group of resellers who are just basically taking used equipment and putting it in place of the kit that's already there so that they don't have to worry about upgrading everything. They can just keep it running and there's no cost associated with it other than, you know, trolling eBay every once in a while.
Well, have you tried to upgrade some of this Avaya stuff? What a nightmare. We've been trying to get the unified messaging portal up and they if you want to change a setting, it lets you change the setting in the GUI front end, but then they tell you, and then it doesn't take, and then they tell you, oh, you have to reinstall. Well, why?
Are you sure you're not running this on Exchange? One of these days, I have to get Greg to agree to do a whole unified communications show because we could talk about things like unified messaging and why they're making my hair turn prematurely gray and fall out.
I could tell you stories offline about the Avaya, like, you know, they don't understand what LDAP is.
Here's the deal. I worked on IP telephony in 2002, and I thought it was a bucket of poo, and it smelleth greatly, and it had no goodness in it whatsoever. And,
Hold back, Greg. Tell us how you really feel about it.
I'm feeling gentle and at peace today. I went to the gym last night and I slapped that boxing bag around for a good 20 minutes. I'm feeling calm. But my life has been it actually says on my resume, there are 6 things on my resume that it says I will not do. And one of them is I will not work on Nortel equipment again in my life. And the other one says I don't do IP telephony.
Well, I don't think you have to worry much about Nortel.
Well, those ERS 8600s, I wasted months of my life trying to make those things go. They've got one very cool feature, SMLT. You've got to admit that SMLT is way cool, except that they patented it and it can't become an industry standard.
And we're Avaya, so.
And that's where.
We've been in Avaya hell, so.
Yeah. But we had a podcast a couple of weeks back about shortest path bridging, which is a Nortel initiative which extends PBB, and the Nortel switches are used very extensively in carrier backbones, mid-sized carriers, regional carriers. And you'll find potentially, at least what I've been told, is that those old Nortel gear is used to backfill carrier networks where they have that kit in. Sorry, I was talking to somebody here. You could have jumped into the space there, people.
we were giving Nortel its moment of silence, of respectful silence.
Mrs. Y, you were telling me this week that you've been focusing on the new 64-bit release of Backtrack 5 and hacking your network there with some tools. Tell us about that.
Sweet. It's finally, you know, I can use 8 gig of RAM for Backtrack. It's awesome. I mean, I just started playing with Backtrack over the last 6 months or so. And so I've mostly been focusing on wireless security. And I've discovered, you know, I've been playing with my friend's application AirCrack NG and Kismet a little bit, but MDK3, which just the name, it's a wireless hacking tool, and it's called MDK, which stands for Murder, Death, Kill. Which it will do to your wireless network. Between deauthentication, you know, I can pretend to be your SSID, and then I can, you know, first I deauthenticate all your clients, then I pretend to be your SSID, but then I change the BSSID every second as I broadcast out beacons. It's so much fun. And I'm doing all this under the auspices of seeing how vulnerable wireless networks were. Not that we really, I know they're wireless, and I think everybody in networking knows, but senior management, I don't think, has figured that out yet. Because they still ask, well, why isn't it as stable as wired? And you're like, it's radio, dude.
The only guarantee with wireless is that it isn't working.
Yeah, you know, a microwave, a cordless phone, the motion sensors.
When we were at the wireless tech field day, the guys who were on that gig, who were all full-time wireless engineers, and I'm just a tag along for that one, I was just sitting there listening to these guys tell me stories about what it is that they... It was amazing. There are fans now that have wireless controllers in them, and that the, you know, the hands-free, the remote control, they use 2.4 gigahertz.
Oh, no.
But what they do is they just turn it on all the time, so there's something transmitting in the 2.5 gig spectrum all the time. Or, you know, they're putting cameras into devices, corporate security cameras, and they're just broadcasting across the entire security spectrum, the whole 2.4. It's just, you know, just endless. All the things that are spectrum using up the available bandwidth,
and even if the air is clean, you're still on a shared medium. Trying to explain to someone why their wired jack was going to be reliably more faster than the wireless, just depending on how many other people they were contending with to get on the air. Yeah. And then it kind of light dawned, you know.
And then if you live in a congested metropolitan area, and you live, say, in a condo, and I can pick up with. Depending on my alpha card, which is 5 dB range, I can pick up probably 30 APs, 30 different SSIDs. So I had a friend recently who said, you know, I keep losing my connection to my wireless network. And so I pulled out iStumbler and I went, oh, well, here's your problem. I mean, it's like saturated. You know what? Just switch to 5 gigahertz. Yeah. Just switch to 5. It's easy.
And I see you've been playing with your Wi-Spy cards as well.
I'm trying to figure out what I'm looking at. So.
I'm with you. I still can't. I was watching these wireless nerds, and they were going like, you know, there'd be some squiggly lines. They'd be going, oh, look at that. That's what they're hauling. I've never seen that before. That's a bit odd. And I'm going like, what are you guys on, you know?
And I watched the 101, the MetaGeek 101 YouTube video last night. And so I feel a little, now I know what this drop-down menu does. Cool. Yeah.
It's like watching Rorschach cards and you're going like, huh? I don't see any boobs in that.
Where's the image of the Buddha in that picture?
That's right.
I can't see it.
What you don't know is that the wireless engineers are all sitting over there elbowing each other in the ribs going, tell them you see a bridge. Tell them you see a bridge. It's all one big practical joke.
So does anybody really think it's a good idea anymore to have a public wireless network as a service? I mean, now that, you know, Android cell phones, you know, that thing came out where they said, oh, if you're on an open wireless network, your credentials can be stolen, you know, wireless cell phone carriers aren't pushing out the most recent version of code anyway. So, you know, you're owned. So why do we think that that's a service anymore?
I don't think it is. I've had several people ask me about creating things like guest wireless networks for their environments. And I go, you want that to be protected. You want it to be, you know, WPA, WPA2 keys, maybe a simpler key than the one you would have for your internal network, but you don't want to have unprotected Wi-Fi sitting around anymore. It's too big of a liability.
Yeah. And they're asking us to do this, and we're literally between security and networking, we're melting down. We're just like, why do you want to do this?
You need OpenFlow. That's what you need.
I know, that solves everything, right?
That's right. Well, I was diatribing earlier about I think OpenFlow will be very big in universities in the very near future because it gives you the new mechanism for controlling very large numbers of devices.
And I did like that talk you did the show the other day on that. That was great.
Oh, thank you. It wasn't me, though. It was the other guy. He's the bright one because he's the guy who actually does OpenFlow. I just listen and, you know, say something and it keeps getting a result. But the I saw the interoperability lab at thing, and I won't go on because I ran on way too long in the earlier section, but very interesting, and I think it's going to be interesting for you to, in that you can use a programmatic function to put a firewall into your access point. One of the other interesting things about wireless that I would look back on the tech field day is that the faster the wireless goes, the actual faster the wireless goes. It's really, really odd. I could never understand why they say that you should disable all the slower rates, right? And I always thought if you made the slower rates, there'd be more bandwidth available for other speeds. So when you're talking about 2.4, they talk about disabling the 1 meg, the 2 meg, the 4 meg, the 6 meg rates so that you've got more spectrum free. Because that makes sense to me. You know, you leave them turned on, and if you're transmitting slower, then there's more bandwidth for other things. But that's not true, because once you're actually, when you're transmitting, you're seizing the conversation, and you actually own the spectrum until you finish. So the faster you transmit and the faster you release, the more bandwidth you actually can mux on top of it. So it just doesn't, so much to learn about wireless.
Yeah, I've been begging the wireless engineers, and they're happy to have me help. They're like, really? Okay, great, awesome. Because it's like you have a parallel network set up. You know, we have our wired network and then we have our wireless network. And, you know, have you ever tried to do wireless in a library? Paper.
Warehouse is worse. They've got this fencing wire in Australia, which is exactly the right. It's a square thing and it's about 2.25 inches long. And it's exactly the same length as a 2.4 gigahertz wireless signal. And it's a Helmholtz cage, dead. As soon as it hits that fencing wire, and that's what they use to separate the bays in a warehouse. So your whole warehouse is like a wireless section. Let me ask me, Mrs. Wire, seeing as you've popped along, what do you think about Apple and their recent outbreak of Mac infections?
Okay, I gotta tell you, you know, I don't know if you guys have ever had to deal with Apple. We're a university, so probably half now of our of the clients in our network, half the nodes are Macs. And, you know, it's like dealing with the Vatican. It's just, I love the products, but they forgot that we saved them. You know, the EDU brought them back from the brink. And because, you know, we had a lot of faithful people, you know, hanging on to their Macs, and then they came back, but they still, you know, the last time I was out in the West Coast and I was in the Silicon Valley, you know, I wanted to visit vendors and I tried to get a visit with Apple to, you know, speak to some engineers, and it was like trying to get into Fort Knox. So they are still taking, it's like they think they're the DOD or something, and they don't want to admit that they have any vulnerabilities. You know, I read this thing this week about how they don't want to admit that there are Trojans, and if somebody gets pwned, they just, you know, don't help them. No, it's not a virus. It's not a Trojan. And they're helping.
I'm not sure that they're actually saying that. What they're actually saying at the moment is the number of people who are stupid enough to download the file, install it, and then open it. And when it says, give me your credit card and I'll remove a virus, pay for it, right? Right? That's what you have to do to make this virus come down. You have to download a program and install it. You idiots. It's not an infection. It's not a zero day. It's not a drive-by malware attack. You know, it's user stupidity of the grossest kind.
But then the Skype client problem. I mean, I still get this quietness on the Mac side, on the Apple side, in that they don't want to, they sort of want to quietly support that urban legend that Macs can't be pwned. And I still have lots of friends in non-IT fields who don't get antivirus or anything else because they think, oh, no, it's a Mac.
So far, I'm not running Mac virus software, and so far, I'm not recommending anybody else to. but I also would like to point out that most of the people I know have a brain in their heads.
Well, that's what's come up recently is the fact that infection vectors have gone from being, you know, protocol holes and zero-day exploits to being perfectly crafted social engineering. Because what's the weakest link? Usually it's the meat robot sitting between the keyboard and the chair.
Yeah.
Did he just say like, robot?
Oh, yes, meat robot. Well, they'll click on anything. My in-laws call me at least once every 2 weeks. I got a pop-up that says I have a virus, and do you really believe it? Well, what should I do? Shut your computer off, wait 5 minutes, and then turn it back on. Okay, the pop-up came back. Oh, crap, you clicked on it, didn't you? Well, maybe. All right, I'll be over to fix it in a little bit. It doesn't matter whether you're running Mac or Backtrack, or if you're running OS 390 on a toaster. If you purposefully install the program, yeah, it's going to infect you.
Yeah.
Your aura of vulnerability be damned.
That's right. If you're going to stick your hand down the toilet bowl and pull it back out to put it in the bin.
But come on, to be fair, some of the vulnerabilities coming out, like the Skype Mac 5.x client that has, you know, they said, oh, maybe it's just a DOS. Oh, wait, no, maybe they can pwn your Mac through it. So revert back to the 2.x client.
Yeah, but virus software isn't going to, I mean, you know, what's the fix here? Put some malware software and some virus software on your machine? That's not going to fix it.
No.
The fix is worse than the cure, right?
Well, antivirus software leaves a lot to be desired, and there are tons of articles out there about, you know, the signature model just doesn't work anymore. It doesn't work in IDS, so it's not really working in anti. What do we? Some of these programs have 40,000 signatures now.
Yeah.
Good God.
Yeah. You've got to look up match every set of packets against a 40,000 point database. Yeah.
And
good luck.
And what is this? I read that some of the new viruses now morph on their own, that they're written to actually change so they can beat the signatures. Not that that was that hard to begin with.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. That's why I'm staying away from it for the time being. I don't think it's there's two ways out of it. What they're talking about at the moment is that Apple will say, provide all your software will be downloadable from the App Store and we'll have validated it before it goes out. And so if you want to be safe, you buy everything from the App Store. Or I think it's just a temporary glitch. There'll be more of this coming down the pipeline as Mac gets bigger. Mm. The point is that the people who use Macs are financially rich targets. And
they actually figured that out. Wait, those laptops cost a lot more than a PC. Let's go after them.
Shiny. Squirrel. All right. Oh, Sony PSN getting pwned again.
Oh yeah.
You heard about what happened, didn't you? So they hacked the database and they pulled everybody's credentials, all of their pertinent information.
Yep.
So what does Sony do? They send out a link telling people that they need to reset their passwords. And so guess what happened? You know what you have to reset your password? Your email address and your birthday, which is what the people stole. So it's like, brilliant, gentlemen, brilliant. So they're like, literally they would bring the network up and it would go back down.
Yeah.
And I think they're up to, are they up to 4 now or is it 5?
I think Sony deserves a little golf clap. Well done.
On the bright side, if you're looking to pick up a PS3 on Craigslist, they're probably going pretty cheap now.
So what is the deal? Do they have like the Three Stooges doing security at Sony? What?
Well, because they set a target and then they missed it. So now it's, well, PSN will be back up when it's done. And then they use the same credentials out of the PSN hack to take on Sony Online Entertainment, which is their big online role-playing game venture. And so they had to shut that down for days on end. It's like, seriously, guys, something's got to give. Use your brains.
So is the Three Stooges a global meme? Does everybody in our international audience understand what she's referring to?
Hey, the Three Stooges are shown in on Italian television. I think everybody knows them.
Yeah, that was
okay.
I grew up with them.
I think the language of hitting someone in the head with a 2x4 is pretty much universal.
I think so.
Exactly right.
Except that for some reason that still hasn't shaken some intelligence loose and at the Sony network.
Security. It's a constant thing.
There's one article that I want to raise here with you. I haven't actually got it on the show list, but here we go. And this article says, why geeks make better adults than the in crowd. And this article can be sort of summarized. It says that in good news for nerds everywhere, what makes people unpopular in the hallways of high school, which is an unwillingness to conform, tends to translate into success as an adult. The author lists several companies, including Yahoo, that prioritize hiring quirky individuals who shun conventional thinking. And those people whose weirdness led to later fame, such as Steve Jobs, Taylor Swift, Bruce Springsteen, and Angelina Jolie. She was doing really well right the way up to that point.
One of these things is not like the other.
I find it's an interesting article. I'll link to it in the show notes. It's talking about the fact that people who don't conform in school often go on to be very successful in later life, and particularly nerds who refuse to accept the status quo and continue to challenge and be accepting of change. And most IT people, in my opinion, are probably more change-driven and change-oriented than just about anybody else around the place. And that if you're conventionally oriented in school and you're not willing to fit in, you're probably not going to make a great IT person. I thought it was a great article. Discuss,
well, except this doesn't include DBAs, though, does it?
DBAs are kind of like the retarded children, aren't they? They're the special needs children. You know,
the short bus.
Disclaimer, I went to school to be a DBA. I quickly decided I didn't want to do it, though.
Yeah. I went through a whole Oracle DBA program to realize, just so I could learn to talk to DBAs, because they have a special language.
Yes, we do.
Yeah.
My first job was an Oracle forums programmer.
Oh no, the dirty dark secret emerges.
Yeah, to be fair, I never thought I was a misfit at school. I thought everyone else was wrong.
Yeah, I will agree with it also. Just, it's always a bunch of strange, it's a strange cast of characters, let's put it that way. You got all your different stereotypes. You got the big guy that knows everything, eats constantly all the time, and is the guy that you go to solve problem X, whatever it is, because he knows everything about everything. And there's the girl who dresses like the rock chick and has the dyed hair and the tattoos, and she knows everything in her little world about everything. And then you just kind of go around the room with everybody in a cubicle, and everybody in IT seems to not fit in some way or another, but works amazingly well in the IT group and is really good at what they do. That's been my experience for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Three cheers for IT people.
Woohoo!
I love this soundboard. This is so much
fun. We're going to have to get a restraining order.
Yeah, you may well do. All right, is there anything else you want to cover? Or are we gone? We done?
I can't think of anything else.
I'm sorry you weren't there for the earlier bit, Mrs. Y. Do you do anything with Junisphere?
Oh, I got really – well, I noticed it's part of the Academic Alliance. They've been trying to get the university to become partners with Juniper on that, and I thought it was really great. But trying to get tenured professors to, you know, do anything is, you know, forget it.
Yeah, they're going to go in their own direction from about 20 years ago.
Exactly. But I'm really excited about Junosphere, and I included a link about I had just seen about a way to virtualize Junos in VMware. Mm-hmm. And so I had been playing with that, and then I saw Junosphere. And the second I saw that, I looked it up on the Juniper site, and then I sent an email to my SE going, how do I get my hands on this?
Well, you don't want to. The network learning program is $5 per hour per day. Is what I've been told. I'm still not sure about that.
Wow.
So it's a gouge. Juniper's nickel and diming you.
So. Now, well, there must be a way that if you buy this, you get this much time, or you can, you know, torture them, because they're trying so hard to sell those SRXs and also their new switches.
Yeah. The program's initiated from within Juniper Learning, not as a company-wide initiative. So there's no loss leader. They have to fully recover their costs and make a profit at it.
That's why my SE, because he knew I would say, what?
Yeah.
I'm not paying for that.
Yeah, well, I was at Interop and they were bigging it up to me and saying I was going to love it and how fantastic it was. And they took the blog post that I made on it and went through it and said, yep, well, we can't do anything about that one. So.
Oh, man. It sucks.
Yeah, they do. I had a few nasty things to say about it and I'm on the outer. Apparently I've offended their PR team.
It's not possible to offend Juniper, is it?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. No, they're really bitchy. Yeah. If Cisco PR is just indifferent, I don't care. They're not even listening, right? All right, let's wrap this thing. So we're an hour and a half in. And don't want to keep editing this too much. It was really good right the way up until when Mrs. Y came along and took us off track.
Body security.
I just want you to come to the security thing so we can have a great time. I think we'd be... So that's it for the show this week, and thanks for listening to Packet Pushers. We should be back again in a week or so. Make sure you come back. I'd like to thank our external resources for joining us this week. Ethan, what are you going to be doing this week, mate?
Firewall Audits and Rebuilds is the focus of my life, for sure. That is, if the tickets, maybe I'll blog something if I can, and of course you can follow me on the Twitter at EC Banks. And my blog is packetattack.org. Would love it if you stop by.
Thank you. And John, what are you going to be doing this week?
I have two more ASRs to bring online on the customer's WAN connection, and I've got a remote site to migrate or upgrade a 2 meg socket to a 10 meg socket. So pretty boring standard stuff.
Oh, okay. And Tom, what are you going to be doing this week?
This week I think I'm going to be finishing up a wireless deployment for one of my clients, and then I'm going to start prepping for a giant call manager deployment. So I get to spend a whole lot of my time waiting on parts to show up and writing configs.
Call manager, dead to me. And where can we find you?
You can check me out on Twitter as Networking Nerd, and you can find my blog at networkingnerd.net.
And John, where can we find you? I just remembered we forgot to cover that.
That's okay. You can find me on the Twitter, _John McManus_. Well, maybe I should shorten that at some point. And at networking-guru.net.
And of course, Mrs. Y, what are you going to be doing this week?
Hiding from my boss, who just figured out that I put Radius deployment on the back burner. And he came to me last week and said, you know, we got to talk. We finally got a PM on that Radius project, so we need to reprioritize that. And I think I just hid under the table at that point. Yeah. Does anybody like Radius, really?
No. You need OpenFlow. That'll fix it.
Yeah.
TACAX isn't any better. There's no good solution out there.
And, of course, I'm Greg Farrow. My week this week is going to be full of troubleshooting EIGRP load balancing after successfully avoiding it for any number of years, and I am stumbling my way through restoring from tape that piece of knowledge which I thought was forgotten. As always, you can follow us on our website at packetpushers.net. Feel free to come along and leave a blog, a comment, and tell us about things. You can follow us on the Twitter at packetpushers, and don't forget to tell us what you know and tell your friends about us so that the show can get a little bit bigger. And remember that too much networking would never be enough.